internationally recognized fair trade standards.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, where University of Illinois students of theater and opera provoke laughter and tears in productions of Shakespeare's comedy As You Like It, Feydeau's farce A Flea in Her Ear, and an evening that pairs two short operas set in Spain, Ravel's L'Ur Espagnol and Defia's La Vida Breve. Visit KrannertCenter.com for more information.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This morning, we're bringing you programs from the Focus 580 archive. So do remember, as you listen, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about American politics, and we'll be looking particularly at the recent successes that the Republican Party has had in advancing its key agenda. Now, we know from public opinion surveys that if you take a look at the broad spectrum of political thinking in the United States, all the way from one side to the other, most Americans tend to cluster around the middle. We also know that in recent years, the Republican Party has become increasingly conservative, moving more and more to the right. And the question we'll look at this morning is this: how is it that the Republican Party, as it has been ruling now with some very slim majorities, and it seems to be to the right of most Americans, how is it that the GOP has managed to achieve a major transformation of America's governing priorities? Why has the GOP been so successful? That is the question that we will take up this morning with our guest, Paul Pearson. He's professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and he is the co-author of a recently published book, which is entitled Off Center. The subtitle is The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. It is published by the Yale University Press. And his co-author on the book, by the way, is Jacob Hacker. He is a professor of political science at Yale. Professor Pearson, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
We certainly appreciate it. Just, you know, to question a fundamental assumption there that I have implied or not implied, just stated right out there in the introduction that I made, that has to do with where most Americans are. There may be some people who would be listening who would question that and who would say something to the effect of, yes, indeed, the Republican Party may have well moved to the right, but they might also assert that American politics generally has moved to the right, that Americans have moved to the right. Can one really say, can you offer some good, solid evidence that says, just as our starting point, that indeed says that most Americans do cluster around the middle, and that now the Republican Party is to the right of most Americans?
Well, that's a really good question, David, and I appreciated the way that you summarized the puzzle that we make central to the book, which is our sense that the Republicans have indeed moved quite a long ways to the right, that the American public on the whole hasn't, and yet they've been able to govern and not just stay in power, but also to do quite a bit in terms of pursuing their agenda while they're in power. So it does immediately raise the question of whether, you know, maybe we've got a key part of the story wrong. Maybe the reason that they've been successful is because the American public has moved far to the right as well. And I think a lot of people looking at American politics would just assume that that has to be the case, that politicians can't win unless they're staying pretty close to where the voters are. And the way that we try to address that question is by looking as systematically as is possible at the polling evidence. And fortunately, this is something that political scientists have done for a very long time. And what they do, and the leading researcher on this is a man named James Stimson at the University of North Carolina, they collect hundreds and hundreds of poll questions where the same question has been asked repeatedly over an extended period of time, so you can make sure that the responses you're getting are really comparable. And from that, he develops an index of what he calls the public mood. And what that shows is that, in fact, while the public mood has fluctuated a little bit over time, sometimes a little more liberal and a little bit more conservative, there isn't any significant swing to the right. And certainly in the period since the early 1990s, where this big transformation has been taking place in American politics, there's no indication in the public opinion polls that the public is moving that direction.
Hmm. And something else, again, just to underline the point that's striking, and I guess it's more striking now that I focus on it, is how on the one hand, how successful Republicans have been in advancing their agenda, and at the same time, how slim the majorities that they have are. One should not forget that when President Bush was reelected, he was received just a few tenths of a percent over half of the votes cast, and that the majorities that the Republican Party has in Congress are really quite small. Six, I think if Democrats were going to take over the Senate, they'd have to pick up six seats. In the House, they'd have to pick up 16, which doesn't seem like very many. And yet, when you take a look at the way things stack up, how many open seats there might be, how many vulnerable incumbents there might be, that it begins to look like six picking up six in the Senate and 16 in the House would be next to impossible for the Democrats. So the point again being that the majorities that the Republicans have are very, very small.
Well, I think you're capturing both parts of the paradox there. They're very, very small, and yet they seem seem quite durable at the same time, which I think really does drive home some of the key things that are going on in American politics. I mean, just to emphasize the first point, there has never been a period in American political history when the two parties were as closely balanced in electoral terms as the Democrats and the Republicans are today. The last three congressional elections, 2000, 2002, 2004, are the three closest consecutive elections in congressional history. Very close balance between the two parties in both the House and the Senate. And, of course, on the presidential side, you mentioned how close it was in 2004. It's been a long time since an incumbent was elected as narrowly as President Bush was. And then we know in 2000, Republicans actually lost the popular vote in the presidential election. So the two parties, in terms of their electoral support, they're incredibly closely balanced. And yet, as you mentioned, Republicans seem to have quite a strong position. And at the same time, that very close balance electorally hasn't seemed to prevent them from being pretty aggressive in pursuing their policy agenda. Mm-hmm.
Let me just raise one further question, and then I have a caller, and we'll get to them. I won't make them wait forever. But that is that some people might make the argument that the Republican success is perhaps due as much to Republican skill in making the system work to their advantage as it is due to lack of the similar skill on the part of the Democrats. They look at the Democratic Party and say, gee, the problem here is leadership. The problem is they don't have a good message, or if they do have a message, they don't know how to communicate it, that they seem to find they seem simply to say that the problem here really is not so much the Republicans being really smart, is as the Democrats not being very smart or not smart enough.
There are a number of big issues there that hopefully over the course of the hour we can unpack. I mean,
sure.
I would want to talk first about what's happened on the Republican side. I always think it makes more sense to focus on the people who are in power than the people who aren't. And we argue in the book that the big change is, in fact, that on the Republican side, it's not as if Democrats all of a sudden became less competent. It's that the Republicans have created a much more coordinated and unified party, really something that we've never seen the likes of in American politics. And again, this isn't something that's just an opinion. One can, Jacob and I are very careful in the book to present evidence wherever there's evidence available to back up the claims that we're making. And there are measures of how unified parties are in congressional votes, for example, and there's never been a party that's been as unified in congressional votes as the contemporary GOP. So there's much more to be said about that, but we think that the fundamental change here that often does make the Democrats look rudderless and less clear in what they're doing, but the fundamental change is that the Republican Party has become much more unified, much more coordinated, And that has been extremely helpful in this closely balanced electoral picture.
Yeah, I think that definitely the central focus in the book Off-Center is Congress and the way that Congress operates. And you seem to be making the argument that the Republicans have been very skillful at managing the process to their advantage, to accumulating power that way and to holding on to it. And there are a variety of explanations, but certainly one of the things that you have everybody being on board and in effect within the party muscling out anybody who's not, making an effort. I think there has been this effort within Republican ruling circles to actually get rid of moderate Republicans so that everybody will be on the same page, everybody will be unified, everybody will be working together for the same agenda. And now that they have that advantage, they seem to be determined to hold on to it.
Yes, I think that's right. I don't know if you wanted to get to I could say more about that, but I wondered if you wanted to.
Yes, I think probably having said that I was going to do that, I think okay. I should. And let me also again, for anybody who might have just tuned in, reintroduce our guest, Paul Pearson. He's professor of political science at the University of California at Berkeley. He has written a number of books. He's written quite a bit about welfare policy in the United States. And just to mention his first, a book entitled Dismantling the Welfare State, that with a question mark. It won the American Political Science Association's Camera Prize for the best book published on American National Politics and Policy in 1994 when it came out. He has written some others, and he is also the co-author of this book that we're talking about here this morning. The title is Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. It is published by the Yale University Press. We do have a caller here to talk with in Urbana. Let's do that. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've got a pair of questions that I hope are related. First of all, this strikes me as an excellent opportunity to answer a question I've wondered about for a long time, and perhaps you know, of all the citizens in the United States, approximately what's the number who are old enough and eligible to vote? Of that number, how many actually register to vote? Because then whenever I get a phone call for polling, they always ask if you're registered to vote. And of the number who are registered, how many actually do vote regularly? This goes to the question of why such slim majorities, whoever gets elected. Would you answer that? And then I'll ask the second, if I may.
Okay. Well, Professor Pearson, do you have those numbers?
I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head, but I can give you rough ballparks. And I think the question's very well taken, because I think the sharp decline in voter turnout in the United States over the last 20 or 30 years, and that decline has especially been in the center. People who are more extreme, either on the right or left, their voting turnout has dropped less. But in presidential elections, roughly 50% of adults who are potentially eligible to vote, in fact, vote. And that's declined significantly, like I said, over the last 20 or 30 years. And, of course, the turnout is much lower in off-year elections. I think it's typically around 30%. And it's lower still in primary elections, which, given some of the changes that have taken place in American politics, and, again, hopefully this is something we can talk about more over the course of the hour, primaries have become increasingly important because so many members of Congress are sitting in safe seats, and the turnout in primaries is very, very low.
It sort of sums up what's been happening. The other question stems from following local politics, this county and this region, and the notion that you brought up before of a more disciplined and effective group effort by one party or another strikes as right, knowing the people I do. But the question becomes, why are some in one party or another willing to get aboard a team and a group rather than work as individuals? Why or in what way do they think of themselves so that they, it's hard to express, who is we and who is them? Who is the group that they were willing to work together with? How do they see themselves? And how do they see the others that they're willing to band against to oppose? I hope I've been clear But
strike. Yeah, I think so. I think so.
For the sake of winning isn't enough. They've got to have, and I hate to bring it in this sense of what group is willing to go all the way to the extreme of terrorism. But at some point, if you define yourself and your opposition harshly enough, people will do a lot of sacrificing. And in this case, I've noticed a lot of sacrificing of individual representatives' impulse or judgment to get the group more effective, and then hopefully something else will follow. So if I'm making any sense, how do you see them defining themselves and defining the other so that the party is more cohesive and the voters more willing to come out and work? That was my second, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thank you. It's clear that maybe the most obvious change that's taken place in American politics over the last couple of decades is that politics has become much more polarized. There are fewer people in the middle. The differences and the level of intensity of antagonism between the left and the right has grown dramatically. And this is something that's often commented on. It's not an original thing to make that observation, but it's typically suggested that this has happened equally on both sides. And in fact, we argue in the book that there's tremendous evidence that, in fact, the polarization that we've seen is not symmetrical. It's not the same on the left and the right. That the Republican Party has moved further to the right in Congress and among its activist base than has been true on the other side. And again, that's something that we go to some length to demonstrate, not just to assert in the book. And so there is this polarization, the sense of it's us against them. But I think it is stronger, particularly at the level of people who are the most actively engaged in politics. It's stronger on the conservative side than it is on the liberal side. So then your question is, why is that? Is there something about the mindset of conservatives and the people who participate at that end of the political spectrum? And I know that there, particularly if you read liberal blogs or something, there would be a tendency to resort to some arguments like that sometimes. But we see the difference as being more a matter of organization than ideology or mindset per se. That Republicans have succeeded in developing a more unified, networked, and coordinated political organization that starts at the elite level. It really starts in Washington, and then they build up organizations and grassroots connections out of that. I mean, I think there's also, not to go on too long about this, but one other, I think, significant difference between the liberal side and the conservative side is that there seem to be fewer cleavages dividing conservatives. There are two major bases of the coalition. One is a religious base, and the other is a business economic base, whereas on the Democratic side you have, I think, more single-issue groups that see their particular issue as being the central thing that brings them into politics, whether it's the environment or civil rights or abortion rights. And that makes it, I think, more difficult to create the kind of unity on the liberal side that you see on the conservative side. Mm.
Well, you know, it's interesting that one of those things that we seem to talk about in politics more and more is the base. It's one of those terms that now people are talking about all the time now, and I'm not sure people talked about so much in the past, although I'm sure it has always been the case that for both parties, there is a core group of individuals that they're the most committed to the party, that they are vocal, they are organized, they're willing to work for the party, they're willing to give money to the party. And those people are extremely important, particularly in primaries when you're at the point where you're selecting candidates. But of course, overall, they're important as well. Within the Republican Party, there has always traditionally been a bit of a spectrum also within the Republicans, at least between those groups that we, for want of a better term, would label the fiscal conservatives and the social conservatives. conservatives. Now it seems that within the last couple of decades, within the Republican Party, the social conservatives are in the ascendancy on the grassroots level, and also in the leadership of the party, they're also in the ascendancy. And so they work hand in hand, and for that reason have been so successful in taking the party in that direction. Why exactly has that happened, though? And particularly, why do you think on the grassroots kind of a level that the social conservatives now have come to dominate the party? And of course, then at the top levels of the party knows that, and they have to address the needs and the concerns of the base. And the leadership is of the party, and so also ultimately the leadership in Congress is perfectly happy to do that. How did that happen?
Well, let me talk first just a second about the base and the growing prominence of the base, because I think you're quite right about that, and then talk a little bit about these different factions. Karl Rove, you know, if people ask what's Karl Rove's big innovation in so successfully managing political campaigns, it would, I think, be the priority that he's placed on the base, on the idea that you don't, as people traditionally have thought, you don't necessarily win elections in the United States by appealing to the middle. That's always been the traditional view, and it's the kind of orientation that we started with in the book. Why isn't the middle dominating American politics the way that it traditionally has? And Rove saw, and I don't think he was alone in this, I think that others in the GOP had figured this out before, that in a political system where, as the caller mentioned, turnout is quite low, and where many people are not that attentive to politics most of the time, and where most representatives are sitting in safe seats, and I think that point probably needs to be underlined. 98% of incumbents these days win re-election. There was more turnover in the old Soviet Politburo than there is in today's House of Representatives. So most people are in safe seats as long as they can get through the primary. And of course, the primary constituency is the base of the particular party. And so those participants have become more important in a political system where fewer people are participating, but a lot of people who are quite intense are participating. And like I said, I think as I mentioned earlier, there's evidence that this process is more advanced and I think further from the center on the Republican side than it is on the Democratic side.
Well, certainly it seems to be the case that in primaries in recent years, we have seen cases where there have been sitting Republicans who have had challenges from the right, from within their own party. Certainly there's no parallel phenomenon on the side of the Democrats.
It certainly is much, much less common. And even though most of those challenges don't succeed, they're kind of like they serve the role of kind of being like an IRS audit. Everybody notices it, and nobody wants it. Even if you survive it, it's unpleasant and potentially damaging. So it keeps incumbent politicians watching to make sure that they don't alienate their base. And of course, the other effect that's less visible but it's quite important is that Eventually, politicians retire or seek a different office or die, and then they have to be replaced. And there's systematic evidence that suggests that on the Republican side, and this is not true in the same way on the Democratic side, but on the Republican side, when a sitting Republican member of Congress leaves office, that they will almost always be replaced by somebody who is significantly more conservative than they were. Mm-hmm. So that's another way in which the base can assert itself. Even though somebody, an established politician, might be able to express some independence, if you're actually trying to enter Congress now and you're on the Republican side, you with almost no exceptions, you have got to be on the conservative wing of the party to have a chance.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Paul Pearson. He's professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the co-author, along with Jacob Hacker, who's professor of political science at Yale, co-author of the book Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. It is published by the Yale University Press. We have some other callers to talk with. Let's go next to Urbana in line two. Hello.
Hello. Wanted to ask if you have given any thought to what extent the current configuration in the U.S. stems from the fact, or how important is it that the Democratic Party has not in many years advanced sort of economic populist or social democratic positions that are sort of characteristic of a left liberal party. I was thinking about this in the connection of Amir Peretz in Israel, who's advocated the idea that, you know, we need to link domestic social reform with, the foreign policy questions. And here in the U.S., we've had, you know, for many years, it's been many years since we had, like, a major Democratic presidential candidate coming and saying, okay, if I'm elected, I'm going to raise the minimum wage, I'm going to really enforce labor law so people have the right to join unions, and I'm going to advance a program of economic reform that's going to improve the lives of the majority of people. So that when many working people go to vote in the United States, they don't see a candidate who's going to do something for them, and so now the elections are free to turn on social issues, wedge issues, religious issues, whatever. So I wondered if you wanted to comment on that.
That's a great question, and you've laid out the argument yourself pretty clearly. But let me say a couple of things about this. I mean, I personally think, and my co-author Jacob Hacker, who's writing independently on this issue, I think we both feel like it would serve the Democrats well to play up economic issues more along the lines that you're talking about. And a major issue, and Jacob actually has a book coming out shortly on this subject, is that there's been a huge increase in economic insecurity in the United States over the last 20 years. So it's not just that inequality is growing in the United States, but that ordinary Americans, middle-class Americans, are much more exposed to a variety of risks associated with potentially with losing their job and not being able to get a similar job or as well-paying a job, losing their health insurance, losing their pension. All these kinds of risks are much greater in the United States than they were 25 or 30 years ago, and that's an issue that Democrats ought to be able to seize. But if I could take just a step back and emphasize a few things that we say in the book about Democrats and the position of Democrats, because I find when we talk about the book that people often want to very quickly say, well, that if Republicans are winning, it's because Democrats are messing up. Or because Democrats are out of step, or not seizing their advantages, and so I'd like to emphasize a few things about the current state of American politics, which place Democrats in a difficult position. Even though, and this is the point that David started the show with, we think there's substantial evidence that on issues, Democrats on average are closer to where the middle of the electorate is. They're closer to the center than Republicans are. So the idea that they have to shift their positions in order to be politically successful, we don't find persuasive because we think their positions. You could argue about places where they might want to change them, but their positions actually are not nearly as out of step with the electorate as the positions of the Republicans on the issues that people say are most important to them. But there are a number of difficulties that the Democrats face. One is that it's very difficult for them to present a coherent position in a situation where they're in the minority and where Republicans have become so unified. And this is just a fundamental change in American politics that I don't think people fully appreciate, is that it's very different being in the minority when the majority holds itself together as well as this majority has, because the majority gets to control the agenda. they get to decide what's talked about in Washington, what issues get talked about, what proposals get talked about, and that's just an enormous advantage. A journalist for the LA Times, Ron Brownstein, described contemporary American politics as like watching a game of baseball where the same team is up to bat all the time, or a basketball game where the same team has the ball all the time. And the reason why Republicans have so much control over the agenda is not so much, to me, a product of Democratic incompetence as it is the fact that the Republicans are extremely unified and coordinated.
Well, that raises the question, though, of why it's the case. I mean, at times, definitely the Democratic candidates have the opportunity, if they used it, to put something out. Like when there's a presidential campaign, like in the last 2 months of the campaign, well, you know, most people are paying attention, and if the Democratic presidential candidate says, you know, I'm going to do X, and he says it loudly and repeatedly, that's going to be reported. And so the question is, and it could be argued that, you know, and I think you're sort of saying this, that there's a difference. One question is, what are the different policies? And the other question is, what do these people say? This is what I'm going to do. Like, everyone who follows this stuff would believe that if there were a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, be more likely to see an increase in the minimum wage.
Right.
But that's different from, you know, the candidate going out and saying, look, there's a tremendous increase in social inequality in the United States, and that's having devastating impacts on communities across the United States. And if I'm elected, I'm going to do something significant about it, and this is what I'm going to do, these clear policies. That's what's not happening. And some explanation is needed for why it's not happening, if it's the case. I mean, you think that they should do this. I think there's a lot of other people think this. The logic to us is clear. So it's got to be more than a mistake. And some people think that it has something to do with kind of the wealth primary in the Democratic Party and how rich interests that contribute to the Democrats have a kind of veto on what the political program is that the Democratic presidential candidate or leading Democrats will put forward. And I'm wondering if you would comment.
Well, I think that's a fair point. I really do. I mean, I agree that presidential elections are the best opportunity you have to press these kinds of issues. It's much more difficult outside of that kind of opportunity where you have a single candidate who really, as you say, can command the limelight and has a chance to put some kind of agenda forward. And at that point, I think you're right that on economic issues, the Democrats are split in a way that doesn't affect the Republican Party in the same way. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that politics has become a very, very big money game. The role of money in American politics has increased by, I don't know, an order of magnitude in the last 30 years. I mean, in terms of what it takes to participate in electoral politics. And that doesn't pose much of a problem for the Republican Party, which is comfortable being the party of business and free markets and using that as a platform for launching a campaign and at the same time financing its campaigns. But on the Democratic side, it poses a tremendous dilemma because they need to raise money, and at least until very recently, and there's some indication that the rise of the Internet may change this a little bit, but at least until very recently, you really had to target affluent people in order to raise those kinds of funds. And that's not just true in presidential elections. It's true for anybody who's interested in running for Congress or running for the Senate. And so a Democratic politician, I think, necessarily finds themselves pulled in two different directions on these economic issues. There's for reasons of appealing to voters, there's a reason to emphasize economic populism. But for fundraising needs, there are reasons to make other kinds of appeals.
I'm going to jump in here. I really appreciate the comments of the caller. We get into our last 15 minutes or a little bit less, and I have some other folks I want to get to. Just real quick, again, not to maybe belabor this point, but it seems one of the things that seems to come through very strongly in the book is the extent to which the Republican Party now manages to control the legislative process to the point where they managed to get it to work their way. And it seems that there is something of a difference in the way politics is now conducted, in that there would have been a time when the majority party would have said, well, we need to work with the minority. And if in the process the minority gets something of what they want, well, that's okay, I guess. That's the way things work. There was this notion that there would be some give and take. It seems, though, that today it's the position of the majority party is that we get everything we want and the minority gets nothing. And we don't have to give them anything. We don't have to work with them at all. There seems to be we have lost most of this notion that there is some give and take, and that there has to be some dealing back and forth across the aisle.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and I'm glad you're taking the conversation in that direction, David, because as you mentioned earlier in the show, we put a lot of emphasis on Congress in mm-hmm. this book. People who talk about American politics often want to focus on the presidency, certainly the media, and the television media in particular loves to focus on the presidency because you can talk about an individual personality and you get dramatic photo opportunities and so on. But Congress is really central to the workings of the political system, especially on domestic issues. Most people are not that interested in focusing in on the details of process and policy as they get worked out in Congress. But we argue in the book that, exactly as you say, that this more unified and coordinated Republican Party has been able to exploit opportunities in the way that Congress is organized in ways that are absolutely critical to its ability to pursue off-center policies. And a lot of that is by holding their majority together, they can control the agenda in the way that we talked about before, which means that if there's something that's threatening to their political coalition, they just keep it off the agenda entirely, like the minimum wage would be a good example, where there's been the steady erosion of the minimum wage because they simply don't let it come up for a vote. And there are lots of other examples of things like that. And then they use their control over the legislative process to write the legislation in ways that are hard for people to understand but that allow them to advance their agenda. And most dramatically, that was done in the case of tax cuts, where they used the process to make the tax cuts look much smaller than they were and look much more equitably distributed than they were. And the Medicare bill, which is just now being phased in, is another excellent example of the way in which control over procedure and agenda was used to produce a piece of legislation that is enormously expensive, but not because it's providing a generous benefit, but because there was nothing done in the bill to provide cost containment for drugs, and because huge subsidies were included in the bill for Republican constituencies.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we talk with some more of the folks who are listening? Let's go to Champagne caller here on line number 3. They're the next in line. Hello.
Hi. You talked about greater coordination among the Republicans. I certainly agree with that. But what about greater deceit, greater coordinated deceit? And I point to the 2004 Republican National Convention, which I think was really a consistent parade of lies. For example, we already knew the weapons of mass destruction was false, as were the ties with Iraq and 9/11, yet they were still being put out there. And let's face it, the general public is fairly uneducated, and a lot of them eat up those lies. I'm not saying Democrats aren't guilty of deceit, too, but it just seems like Republicans are much better at it.
Well, I think you're right to say that when you have more coordination, when you have more unity, it allows you to do a lot of things in politics, including deceive people. And I wouldn't shy away from acknowledging there are lots of examples in the book in which practices have been engaged in, both in terms of the kind of message that's conveyed, and of course coordination helps you to stay on message, which is very important in mass politics, but also to write things into law in ways that are clearly designed to distort people's impressions of what's going on. Let me just give you one prominent example of that, which again comes back to the tax cuts, which is on the domestic side, I think, the most important thing that the Republican majority has been able to do in advancing their agenda. And the tax cuts in that bill, the benefits that were going for middle-income households, people got a check within a couple of weeks after the legislation was passed in 2001 with a nice letter from Congress and the White House saying, you know, here's your money. And the enormous benefits that went to the wealthiest Americans were not presented in that way. They were phased in much more gradually, much more indirectly, in a way, and the idea was, well, people aren't going to notice this as much. So, you know, two of the tax cuts that were passed in 2001 just went into effect this last week. They were finally implemented on January 1st. And those benefits, where there's no news attention to this at all, essentially, 97% of the benefits of those tax cuts go to people making over $200,000 a year. Over 50% of them go to people making over $1 million a year. So it's not just the kind of language that's used that creates deceptions, but the actual design of the legislation.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We're really getting short on time and have a number of others, and I hope he won't mind if I want to go on and include some others. And next, I believe, we'll go to Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hello?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to point out one thing that I heard you talk about on Fresh Air, actually, and that was that how the GOP has made besides been able to protect potentially vulnerable Republicans, to quote you, by letting them vote against the party in order to make them seem more in congruence with their presumably mixed opinion districts, and because that I think that highlights this deception thing you were talking about before, and it actually has some relevance to this particular district that you're speaking in right now. But I have a question as well, and that is that you've been talking about how the low turnout has been historically for elections. And Jesse Ventura talked at this campus a while ago, and he pointed out that there were large turnouts whenever there were third-party candidates where people could really get enthusiastic about what those third-party candidates, what their platforms were. So I'm wondering, isn't your argument for an excluded middle? It seems to me that it's just another argument for the establishment in a lot of ways. And part of the reason I suspect so is that you come from academe you know, there's no sign that the academy is interested in losing its prestige or power. And could you speak to that at all? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, there are a bunch of good points there, and I appreciate your drawing attention to this issue of how moderates are protected by a variety of, or people who claim to be moderates is a better way to put it, are protected by a variety of techniques that the majority uses, because that is a central argument in the book. We coined this term backlash insurance, which is that the GOP has perfected techniques to help protect its potentially vulnerable politicians from electoral backlash. And one way they do that is by creating opportunities for vulnerable members to appear moderate, even if they're not really very moderate. And of course, one way, and there are a bunch of ways in which this can be done, and it is done every day in Washington. But one prominent way in which it's done is to make sure that you have enough votes for some controversial measure, and then to release a few members of your majority to vote on the other side if it'll help them burnish their image as being independent of the leadership or moderate for their district. And the GOP majority has become quite sophisticated at doing this, at providing potentially vulnerable politicians with this kind of cover that doesn't cost them anything. And there are a variety of other techniques that are used to achieve that same effect, and I think it is quite important in helping individual politicians stay popular with their district, even if voters have serious misgivings about what's going on in Washington. And then the caller mentioned this idea of that you could get higher turnout if you had a third party. I think that's true. I think Ventura is right about that. That often adds excitement to a race and brings in people who have been excluded from the process. There are actually a lot of ways. We talk about this in the book. There are a lot of ways in which you could increase voter turnout. It's not that we don't know how to increase voter turnout. It's that there hasn't been the political will in Washington to do that. This is a real problem that we talk about in the final chapter of the book, is that it's not as if there aren't good ideas for political reform out there that would make the system more transparent and that would empower moderate voters. But the problem is you have to have people elected who are willing to do some of those things. So it is a pretty profound chicken and egg kind of problem. And then just lastly on this issue about the fact that I'm from academia, I mean, I think it only makes sense in these kinds of conversations to focus on the arguments that people are making, and rather than to say, well, this argument must be wrong or it must be inadequate because look where you come from. And you know, what we try to do in the book is to present the most evidence we can and the clearest argument for what we think is right. And I'm delighted to have conversations to focus on whether we've got the story right or not.
We are almost out of time. We have just a couple of minutes left. And I guess the last thing I'd like to give you a chance to talk about for 2 minutes would be this question of if you say, all right, you're a Democrat and you're interested in seeing the Democratic Party haul itself up out of the hole in the ground that it seems to be in, or maybe you're just saying, well, I think of myself as an independent, but I do think a healthy system would be one where there's an opposition that actually has some power and you want to have a little bit more balance. It seems that given the point where we are, though, in politics in this country, that it's one wonders just how much things might change. What possibly could change?
Well, I think the next year is going to be an enormously important year in American politics. The Republican Party has had a very bad year, and there are a lot of people who, when they hear the argument of our book, say, well, this may have been true before, but look at what's going on now. The Republican Party is falling apart. And that's still, I think, quite possible that the scandals and all the various problems that the administration and that the congressional Republicans have run into over the last year will catch up with them in 2006. But it's going to be a very tall hill to climb. And I think that to us is one of the most disturbing things. We wrote a piece in the New York Times Magazine about this recently, and actually you can find there's a bunch of information about the book and some other writings that we've done on this at our website, which is hackerpearson.com. But what we write in that New York Times article is that even in a situation where Republicans have become much more unpopular, it will be extremely difficult to win even the 15 seats that Democrats would need to win to regain control of the House in 2006. 15 seats used to be an easy pickup for an opposition party under circumstances like this, but now incumbents are so well protected, backlash insurance is so well refined, that picking up 15 seats is an enormously tough hill to climb, and the Senate, of course, poses the same kind of problems. So I do think this is going to be a very telling year in American politics, and that people need to understand the strength and protections that the majority party has created, even in a climate where they're facing enormous difficulties and growing unpopularity. And that our view in writing the book was that understanding how that system works is the first step in doing something about it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that and you also have to point the finger a bit at the minority party if you say that part of the problem is this kind of gridlock in the system that says that about the only way you can ever get any change is if there are ever any open seats, and the fact that now it is next to impossible. It's not totally impossible, but it's extremely difficult to unseat an incumbent.
Right.
That the only way the system is ever going to change is if you get people in there who are willing to see the system change, and it doesn't really seem that anybody, minority or majority, wants to see the system change.
Well, and I have to say that, if I can quickly, that the the reaction so far of congressional Democrats to the scandals that are breaking in Washington, I find disturbing, because it does suggest that there's, rather than jumping on it with both feet, there's a certain amount of ambivalence, because they're concerned that some Democrats might be tainted with it too. And I mean, it's clearly, I think people who follow the news reports on this carefully, it is clearly an overwhelmingly Republican scandal. I mean, Abramov was clearly a leading Republican operative and was part of the kind of machinery that we talk about in the book. But nonetheless, at least some Democrats are very reluctant to push very hard on this, because they're afraid that all incumbents will be made vulnerable by it.
Well, there we'll have to stop. The book is Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy, published by Yale University Press, by Jacob Hacker, who's political science professor at Yale, and our guest this morning, Paul Pearson, who is professor of political science at University of California, Berkeley. Professor Pearson, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on, David.
You've been listening to a Focus 580 interview first broadcast earlier this year. It comes from the Focus Archives. If you'd like to hear some past programs you might have missed, or listen to interviews from the Afternoon Magazine or any other of our local production, you can go to that website anytime that you like. It's will.uiuc.edu. We hope that you will enjoy the rest of your day. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, from new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's about 2.5 minutes before 12 noon Central Time, and we'll kick off the Afternoon Magazine for this Monday. I'm Tom Rogers, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. In the 1 o'clock hour, after our hour-long look at news and the noon hour, Kimberly Cronick will be taking the mic, and she'll be talking with Byron Katie, a self-help facilitator and businesswoman, and should make for an interesting interview. She'll be in the 1 o'clock hour, 106 Central Time after NPR. The closing market report comes your way at 2 o'clock, and followed by more of the Afternoon Magazine, and then The World from PRI at 3 p.m. That's the agenda for the afternoon on this Monday. Let's take a noontime look at the commodity markets at the moment. We see pretty much a lot of green on the Board of Trade. In Kansas City, the March wheat contract is at $3.99.5, up 5.75 cents. In Chicago, the March wheat is at $3.48.25, up 4.75. The May, $3.59, up 4.25. In the corn pit, March is at $2.19.25, up a half. May at $2.19, up a half. $2.29, rather, for May corn. That's up a half a penny. July at $2.38, up a half. And September also up a half at $2.45. In the soybeans, March contract is at $6.01.5 right now, up 12.25. The May at $6.